The Friday Reporter launched in March of 2021 as a conversation with today's journalists and has expanded to include newsmakers, lawmakers, image makers, and just about anybody who's in the news or the news adjacent business. The podcast is in partnership with PR Daily and is part of the Big Wig Podcast Network. If you like the show, please hit the subscribe button to make sure you've got ready access to the latest conversation. And if you've got an idea for a great guest, don't forget to send your ideas to Lisa at FridayReporter.com. Well, there's only been two ever guests that have come on twice. And there's only been now two episodes where I have hosted more than one guest. So today's episode is with everybody's favorite Wall Street Journal writer, Brody Mullins, and his fantastic brother, who is now has been with the Washingtonian for years and now with Politico magazine, Luke Mullins, who are getting ready to announce or share, I think, probably the most anticipated book in Washington, D.C. Everybody I'm talking to is buzzing about the work that these two guys have done, and I'm lucky enough to catch them before the book hits the newsstand. So thank you both for being with me.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So first off, I have to ask, did you both plan to come to Washington at the same time to be journalists? Like, how did you both land in this town and how did that happen before we get into the process of writing a book with your sibling?
All we had to do is be born in D.C. and we were here. So Luke and I are strange people who are actually from Washington and then didn't leave. I think we both came to took different paths to being reporters, but, you know, unfortunately, if you want to be a political reporter, D.C. is the only place to go. You know, it's a long step down to Albany or Sacramento or Springfield, Illinois, you know. So, but, you know, being a political reporter in D.C. is great. It's a lot of fun. And we've both been doing it for about 20 years, I think.
So, but both of you have been investigative journalists for a long time and have written different things. Luke, tell me a little bit, because I haven't quite had a chance to catch you about your background. Sure. Tell me a little bit about how you came to be at the Washingtonian, now at Politico.
Yeah. So I, when I decided I wanted to go into journalism, I was sort of less interested in kind of daily sort of beat writing and more into sort of, you know, longer form, you know, magazine writing, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And I was working for US News and World Report. God, this was maybe 15 years ago. And they were really sort of moving out of the magazine, sort of what I would, you know, what I think of as magazine writing, into more, you know, a lot of lists and things like that, which had financially worked out great for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the few places that was sort of investing in like actual magazine writing was Washingtonian Magazine.
Yep.
And I was there for, 10 years or more. And I had a really big purview. I could write about basically anything I was interested in. And, you know, for many years, you know, they would, you know, they would give you the time and space to do,
That's
it
fantastic.
The right way.
That's so, and there's so few places.
It was a lot of fun.
So then,
can I ask my own question? Now we had like a bunch of reporters. Now I get to ask the question. So, Luke, you were at the American Banker before, and then
I was. Yeah,
can you tell the story about being the stock picker for U.S. News?
So, I started working at American Banker. That was my first job, and that was it was covering like financial regulation. American Banker is a great news, like a very. You know, the publication made money, so they had, it was a good place to learn, essentially, because they still had mid-level editors and stuff like that. But I really did not want to be in banking because it was just so complicated. I had a really hard time learning all that stuff. It was not what I wanted to be in. But my next job, this is during the financial crisis, at U.S. News and World Report, they needed somebody to do, like, finance and economics, which I didn't want to do, but I kind of could do. But one of the things that I did was like pick stocks. That was part of what they did, right? Was like, and I would really like wrestle with it. I'm like 27 years old. Like I don't want like some woman to like put their some old, like old lady like put their
all her retirement
all their money into something. And I remember this is what Brody's telling me. As I remember telling my editor. I was like, how I was feeling. And he said, people get what they deserve. He said, like, if they're just going to just going to read a newspaper article or a magazine article and put aside, that's what they deserve. And I was like, oh man. Yeah.
And so here you are now writing about lobbying. Talk to me a little bit, you guys, about how the book came to be.
So I don't remember exactly how Luke and I connected. Luke, maybe you remember, but you know, I've covered lobbying for my entire career, even before the Wall Street Journal. So I've sort of always been in business and lobbying. And people had approached me about writing a book, and I never thought I had sort of something to say or the attention span to write something that takes years and years and years. And then I had written stories about a couple of the characters who ended up being in our book that sort of, I felt like, could use some more space. Like, I feel like a long story in the Wall Street Journal was not enough. Mm-hmm. And I could see how a couple of these characters could piece together into one story. And all of a sudden I thought like, hey, there could be a book here. And then I think Luke and I got together, and Luke, tell your version, is like, you know, we're both writers. Obviously we're brothers. So we could work well together. And the idea was like, maybe if we each have half the time to do a book, then together we could do a full book, given that we both have, you know, we're both married and have kids and have jobs. Mm-hmm. So we thought like this could be a good, you know, collaboration, and it ended up being perfect. Is that how you remember, Luke? I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, generally. I mean, I remember after the Court of History 2017, you were hearing from agents and stuff like that. So that, I think, is where the idea came about initially. And you asked, like, if this was something I would be interested in teaming up with you on.
So this is and I wasn't kidding when I said, like, everybody's buzzing about this book, and I'm wishing you guys like as much success as I'm hearing about it on the street, because everybody wants to get their hands on it. How much can you tell me about, and I've read some of the excerpts that have been out there, how much can you tell me about sort of the construct of the book? It's about a couple of sort of super well-known players in Washington, D.C. Yeah. that are well-known lobbyists.
So the way that we sort of structured it was around, we think of them as three different lobbying dynasties, right? So the Tommy Boggs, you know, would be one dynasty. Black Manafort Stone, another dynasty. Tony Podesta would be the third dynasty. Some of those dynasties, you meet multiple people, sort of, you know, an older generation and a younger generation mm-hmm. within the dynasty. So then you're following this sort of set of lobbyists over a very long period of time, over about 40 years. And sort of through them, you get into this sort of evolution of lobbying, both sort of in terms of tactics and in terms of influence, from really the early 70s until today. Mm. So that's sort of how it is structured.
Interesting.
To add a couple things. We had these really cool stories about super colorful people. Jim Cordovich, Evan Morris, and Tony Podesta. And we want to try to like weave them together and figure out like, what is there like a broader story that they tell? And it turns out they tell two stories. One is how lobbying has changed from the Tommy Boggs era of the inside game and campaign donations and smoke-filled rooms and backroom deals and right. relations between lobbyists and members of Congress. I mean, that era doesn't exist anymore, even though I think everyone outside of DC thinks that's how things work.
Yeah.
So we sort of trace things from how things used to be, and we picked Tommy Boggs as sort of like the ultimate insider relationship lobbyist, you know, of the 1970s and 80s. And then we sort of follow other lobbyists as they sort of move lobbying more outside of Washington to more public affairs and grassroots and more, you know, modern lobbying and constituents and third party groups and, you know, the way the game mm-hmm. is played today, which right. your listeners actually understand.
Yeah.
during that time, we also realized that we're also in an era of very strong corporate influence and power, which I sort of thought, even as a Washingtonian, I thought companies have always been really powerful in Washington. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, they're powerful now. And you look back, you're like, oh, well, there was the trust busting days and Standard Oil, and there's AT&T, and there was the Rockefellers, and there was the railroads, and there was, you know, JP Morgan. And so I sort of thought from that JP Morgan era to now, companies have always been dominant. Well, it turns out that's not true. And that if you look back through history, every 20 or 30 or maybe 40 years is sort of a new dominant force in politics. Sometimes it's like 150 years ago, it's the people, it's the populace. Sometimes it's companies, sometimes it's labor unions. I mean, from the New Deal to the Great Society, I mean, unions and public interest groups, like Ralph Nader was more power. Ralph Nader took down one of the biggest U.S. companies of this century, General Motors, you know, one guy with the backing of the people. Anyway, so we realized that, like, this is an era. So all of a sudden, we're sort of documenting this era. And what's sort of funny is we started writing this book in around 2017, and it was about how companies and corporations got so powerful in Washington. What we didn't know is that at that exact moment, companies started getting less powerful and less influential because of the Trump populism and some of the Republicans who have gotten more populist and the AOCs on the left. So now, you know, we don't know where we're going, but, you know, we sort of hit an inflection point. And maybe this era is coming to an end. And what is the next era? Mm-hmm. We don't know. But anyway, those two things I thought were really interesting also. And we're trying to tell stories about these really interesting lobbyists that tell those two broader stories.
How much of the book was informed by the reporting that you guys have done over years? And how much was it additional research and work outside of that?
Oh, I think it's sort of similar to the last answer, that the people, we sort of knew the people and we didn't know the context.
Right.
A lot of the reporting was to figure out the context, like, oh, here's where we're in a moment in time, mm-hmm. and here's where we are. And obviously,
that whole part about the, you know, again, the idea of, you know, the power of corporations relative to unions and consumer groups in the 70s, like that stuff was totally brand new to us. Like, we had no idea. You know, there is a lot of literature on that type of stuff. So parts of it, right, were, you know, parts of it were certainly new. You know, the players, but even a guy like Tommy Boggs, who we were like kind of familiar with, but, you know, lots of what we found out that we didn't know at the time, right? It's a lot.
If you've written a story, so Luke had written a great story in the Washingtonian about Tony Podesta, and I had written a story about Tony Podesta in the Wall Street Journal. That didn't mean we were done. We went back to the beginning and found great stories about what made Tony Podesta Podesta. And what made him Tony Podesta was that his first job was with some no-name group, People for the American Way. In the 1980s, Tony Podesta worked for People for the American Way, which is sort of a not very well-funded group that was trying to take on the Christian right. And the Christian right was really powerful, and they had lots of money, and they had lots of influence, especially in the Reagan administration. And Reagan was putting in all these conservative judges, and Tony Podesta was running this little group trying to block them. And Tony Podesta realized, we can't match them on money, so let's try to use the media. Yeah. So he went out and sort of staged like gimmicky events to get media attention. Media attention he would then send to Hollywood folks who would donate money to him. Mm-hmm. And he realized that like he could use the media to take on money. So when
he then again, which I didn't know until halfway through reporting this, was he was a very influential part in the Bork fight, which was this sort of, you know, landmark event in Washington, and he was one of the people who was helping Ted Kennedy whip up opposition. So he learns a lot of those tactics sort of as this liberal activist, and then sort of, you know, Tony Podesta will do some sort of inside lobbying also, but sort of use those skills to help push the envelope on outside lobbying tactics, which he did very well for corporations.
Yeah.
For example, one of his early clients was the dietary supplement industry.
Right.
Mm. And so it's like millions of like old ladies and like sports buffs and like fitness people who take these pills, and the FDA was trying to crack down on them. I think this is the 90s or so. Mm-hmm. And they have this tiny trade association and they can't take on the FDA. So they just put little sign up cards or basically left like business cards at all like the GNCs or whatever those, you know, dietary supplement shops are. And every time someone walked in, they would see this note that said, the FDA is trying to take away your pills, like call your senator. And like people started calling.
Wow.
And that cost no money.
He also famously ran an ad campaign, TV ad campaign with Mel Gibson, where Mel Gibson, there was like a SWAT team of FDA agents, you know, so they... so we actually, I mean, Tony Podesta, you know, we sat for several interviews with him So he talks, you know, in depth about all
but I think like the way to this is a long answer to your simple question.
No, it's good.
Did we do more reporting? Here's also about Tony Podesta that we didn't know that we sort of dug up later and realized that like there's this incredible background that made him into who he was.
Yeah.
And
like I had no idea that Tony Podesta, like many people in Washington know Tony Podesta as Tony Podesta, the liberal activist. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that that part of his life existed just because I wasn't older, you know?
Luke,
and we said to him,
you bring up a good point too, Brody, as you're getting there. So folks helped you, like you had good cooperation as the book came together.
Well, from the principles folks were writing about, was it just Tony Podesta that we talked to, Brad?
A couple of other people.
Some of these folks are
hard to talk to.
Right, sure.
But you know, it's interesting about writing a book, you know, it coming from the Wall Street Journal or Washington or Politico, like, you know, we have a megaphone and we have a hammer and people will talk to us. When you write a book, like people want to talk to you because you're like, this is history. This is not some newspaper article that the next day is being recycled. I mean, this is, you know, even the internet, things can be, you know, hidden on, but like, this is like, you know, well, one, this is history, but two, we're going back and asking about things that happened 10 years ago.
Right.
And at the time, you know, I'm sure you've been involved in these things. That, you know, when a scandal's happening at the time, like, no one wants the insiders companies don't want to talk about it. The PR people don't want to, like, you were trying to hide it. 10 years later, you're like, why didn't they want to write about that thing? That was so interesting.
Yeah.
And so we come back, we're like, hey, tell us about that fight. And they're like, oh, I've been dying to tell people about this.
Oh,
you know,
I love
so
it.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, that's cool. I think that probably makes it a lot more fun to write. So you've been at it since 17. But this is a long process. And now the book is finished and coming out May 9th, if I'm not mistaken, right? May 8th. That's next week.
I thought it was the 7th. Am I wrong? Anyway, regardless, it's coming out very soon.
Next week, this book is hitting the newsstands, and I'll make sure that there is a link so people know how to get it. Talk to me about now, I mean, because you guys, this is your first book together, so you're on the journey that maybe you can help illuminate for myself and for the listener. What's next? There's a big process to selling this and making sure people are aware of it. I know you've got book signings, you've got other things that are coming. Talk to me a little bit about that process and how that goes.
So that's a process we knew nothing about. I think Luke and I, when you're starting writing a book, we're like, well, we know how to write a sentence. Like, can you write 100,000 sentences or however many sentences are in a book? And like, we knew we could eventually get there, although we had some doubts. But after a book's written, the process of promotions is nothing that we had ever done before. So it's as you probably know, it's a pain in the butt. But you know, we've been sort of like pouring all of our resources into it. We have a bunch of excerpts coming out. We have a bunch of book. We have a New York Times book review, knock on wood, that'll be positive. And we've got a bunch of stuff like that. I feel like once the book comes out, there's almost at that point not much we can do. It's sort of make it on TV or you don't. Mm-hmm. Like right now, we can work really hard to try to get on TV. But like once it comes out, you know, it catches fire or it doesn't. But I have to say also, if this book didn't sell at all, I feel like it's a really good book. I'm really proud of this book. I know Luke is proud of this book. And like, I mean, my 11-year-old daughter said last weekend, hey, Dad, like when you're dead, I can read your book. And I was like, exactly. You can go read my book once I'm dead. You know? I think, you know, she meant like, this is me around longer than you are, you know, and there's something kind of cool about that.
It is very cool. It's a resource. But also you said that because you're now in the preview portion of this process, you mentioned before we got on air that there's a whole other set of writing that goes along with this as you're developing excerpts and other things. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can. There's a new term of art in publishing with regard to excerpts where we had just sort of assumed that, you know, an excerpt's going to run, they take chapter 7 or whatever, and it just goes in there. And it turns out that everything is now adapted excerpts, which basically mean they're sort of kernels of information in various parts of the book that a news outlet wants to turn into a full sort of article.
Sure.
And we're like thrilled to do that. But it has been a lot more work than both of us expected.
Yeah.
You know? And you kind of go through the whole, you go through the editing process again. Then you're like, oh man, with all these changes, we got to go fact check this thing again. You know, got to go out to people for comments again, you know? I was just, that part has surprised me, that how intensive, you know, that has been.
Well, it's been fun for those of us who can't wait to read it, because we're gobbling it up and can't wait to see more of that. So it's appreciated, if nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you'll love it, and people in the DC community will love it. Maybe not some of the people who we write about, but, you know, it's sort of a book about our time and our industry and our, you know, place in this city. It's sort of how Washington became what it is, where it takes everything that we do in DC and puts it in a historical context. And plus the stories are really fun to read.
I also think, and this is just, you know, this is just Lisa, the PR person, but this is the kind of book that Washington, D.C. has lots of books, and they're all very different and cool and interesting. But this is one that I think Hollywood and other writers will have an interest in. That's my point of view, because I think it's interesting enough to be the kind of thing that could be consumed in a different way, whether it's TV or film or otherwise, because it is something that you don't see a lot of it. And anytime you do, it's tremendously successful.
Yeah, that's the thing. There haven't been a lot of lobbying books, certainly, you know, in the recent past.
Well, when we started researching, I mean, maybe one of the reasons I never thought there was a book to be done on lobbying is because I remember being younger and reading Jeff Birnbaum's Showdown at Gucci Gulch, and I was like, you can't beat that book.
Right.
Well, that book was about the 1986 tax bill.
Right.
So somehow time has flown, and like, no one's written about this in 40 years.
And the whole world has changed. I mean, as you said, totally. I mean, everything is different now, and it's going to continue to be different because, as you said, I mean, it changes every decade or so. Things turn over in different ways. That's absolutely amazing. Yeah. So then will you travel? Will you go other places outside of D.C., or are you spending most of your time marketing here inside of the Beltway? How does that look for you guys?
I think we're doing both. It's obviously a lot easier to plan events in D.C. Because we know people here, and we sort of know the – you know, who to call, and those people know us and they're our friends. Planning events in Austin is harder. Like, every time you pick a new city, it's sort of reinventing the wheel.
Sure.
But we're trying to find people who we know or could host us in various cities and then do an event or two or three there.
Well, I've got lots of friends. I've got lots of friends that listen here from all over the country.
Well, let us know.
Let's let them know that if they want to host a book signing or a book event.
That actually would be very helpful. I mean, so we have a contact in Austin who's doing a couple of events in Austin. We have someone in Dallas. We have someone in Miami. We have someone in. We're actually doing a Nantucket event because, you know, some lobbyists happen to be in Nantucket.
Lots of
August.
Them.
So, but that's what we're looking for. Is trying to and San doing San Francisco, and I'm trying to do LA and San Diego. So we're trying to do lots of things.
That's amazing. Okay, so there's two Mullins brothers. Are there other Mullins siblings too? Is this just the two of you, or are they more of you? Are there other writers in this family dynasty?
We have another brother. Yeah, we have another brother, John. He's not a reporter, but he's a he's an accountant who does a lot of audits. He runs a lot of audits, and you know, you find out all kinds of, like, there is an investigative piece to all of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. He's the one who can do. He's the one who can do math, though, is what you're telling me.
Yeah,
because you know,
and the one who makes the money in the family.
Well, there's always got to be one. You guys, this was so fun today, and I wish you all the very best. And I'll make sure there's a link, and everybody knows how to find the book. And I know that I can't wait to see you next week at one of the book signings that I'm coming to see. And I wish you all the very best. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much.
Awesome, Lisa. Thank you.
See you soon.
Well, there you have it, another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. I love having this show. I love you to be part of it. Thanks again. Thanks to PR Daily for being a partner, and thanks to the folks at Big Wig Podcast for letting us be part of their network. See you soon.